Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on his plan to transform the waterfront and protect the city from rising sea levels.
This is our vision for a resilient Boston. It's a system not of barricades, but of beaches and parks and trails and open space that are elevated to block floods and enhance and unlock opportunity.
Also today, we sit down with Democratic 3rd Congressional District candidate Lori Trahan.
I'm running to be a voice for families like the one I grew up in. We were one of those families that lived paycheck to paycheck.
And ahead of Boston's Asian American Film Festival, we speak with one of the stars of the now 25-year-old movie, The Joy Luck Club.
You're not taking my house. You're not taking my daughter. You're not taking any part of me.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A new vision for the Boston waterfront. That's essentially how Mayor Marty Walsh describes his plan to protect the city from rising sea levels. Here's the mayor at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce this morning.
It calls for 67 acres of new space and 122 acres of revitalized open space on the waterfront. It links to our Emerald Necklace and reflects the same values of public health, public access, and world-class design. It's a vision of a city more connected to our waterfront and to each other.
And Mayor Walsh is now on the line with us to tell us more. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me today.
So this plan that you outlined to the Chamber of Commerce today involves 67 acres of new space along 47 miles of shoreline?
Yeah. It really is about creating neighborhood level plans covering the entire shoreline that we have here in the city of Boston. We released Climate Ready South Boston. That's a plan to look at the South Boston waterfront. Today we also putting up two new RFPs for Climate Ready Dorchester and Climate Ready Downtown. Each area has resilient projects that need to be completed. Some of them have begun, some are proposed, and it really is looking at how do we handle what we've seen around the country, whether it's been Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Maria or Florence or Michael. Those are the storms that have devastated parts of America and you know, caused deaths and billions of dollars in damage. And a lot of these, if we made some investments up front, those cities would be in better positions.
Mm-hmm. So describe a little bit of what this plan would include, some of the big parts of it.
I mean, a lot of them are big parts, but for example, we're looking at areas of the plan that we're making capital investments in the city of Boston, like in the North End with Langone Pupula Park. We're doing that park over. By raising that park up, allows us the opportunity to create almost like a barrier. It's open space. It's space that's going to be green space, and it's an opportunity for us to not just build new fields for the kids and people to play on, but it's also an opportunity to have resiliency and protect the North End. And Martin Richard Park down on the Four Point Channel, we're installing opportunities down there as well as we do that park over. And along with the Four Point Channel Park, that will preserve sea level rise in the Four Point Channel. We'll protect areas like South Boston and Dorchester and the Back Bay and other parts of our city that would be flooded if and when these floods and the sea level rises. Moakley Park, creating an opportunity in Moakley Park to protect three housing developments that are in that area and tens of thousands of other residents in those areas. So we're looking at different areas. So there's not one area that's bigger than the other. It really has to be a comprehensive look, and it is a comprehensive look at different parts of our city.
You know, a lot of us probably remember Morrissey Boulevard. When you mentioned Moakley Park, but Morrissey Boulevard in particular in these past winter storms, what's going to be happening there?
Marcy Boulevard's another project. DCR has a plan that's going to raise, elevate Marcy Boulevard, which will help us with the flooding, but also allow it to be used as a buffer towards like Savin Hill, the Savin Hill area of Dorchester, and connecting Victory Road Park and Tinian Beach is another way, making those connections. Literally, it allows us the opportunity as we think about protecting the shoreline, protecting businesses and homes and opportunities. It also allows us the opportunity where the open space comes into play is we're using these natural resources as an opportunity not just to create a buffer, but also create more open space and contiguous open space that allows people to be able to get closer and connected to the water.
So what's sort of the main strategy, would you say? What's the primary philosophy behind this vision?
I mean, I think the philosophy is protecting our assets, whether they're people or their businesses or it's economic development. And what we haven't had is that we've been doing a lot of work in this area over the last 4 years or 5 years since I've been mayor and before that, but we haven't had an overall plan on how we make these connections and how we truly do a universal, if you will, connection point. And the way I explained this today is that, you know, in New York after Sandy or in New Orleans after Katrina, there was resiliency built into those areas that if sea level rise happens or a superstorm surge happens, that they'd be prepared for it today if they did it beforehand. And that's what we're doing. We're learning from what happened around the country. You do it beforehand, it's going to save investments. It's going to save FEMA for having to pay money back in disaster relief.
So when you're designing this plan of seawalls and natural barriers and elevated landscapes and all of this along 47 miles of shoreline here, I'm wondering what sort of predictions are you looking at in terms of how much sea level might rise along the shoreline in Boston?
There's studies that in certain parts of the city, it's going to, by the year 2070, there are going to be certain parts of our city that could be underwater if we do nothing. There was a study put out by scientists last week that showed that the world has to take action by 2040 or there'll be some significant issues around global warming and climate change that's happening.
So that's the United Nations report.
The United Nations report that came out the other day. Those are real reports, and those are real concerns for all of us. And you know, we're seeing great growth in our city and great investment in our city. And what we want to do is, and a lot of people, a lot of business owners have already, you know, created opportunities. Whether they put up sea barriers around their building, or they've moved the utilities up in the building. And as I said today, that you know, that's great for protection for your building, but you potentially will be on an island because property lines won't protect you from sea level rise. And it really is important to come up with a comprehensive plan and how we look at protecting different parts of our city. We're going to pay for this by we made a commitment today to put 10% of our capital spending every year towards resiliency. We already dedicated in the last couple of capital budgets over $232 million in climate preparedness and open space projects. That number is going to increase in the future. We have some private developers like 150 Seaport, who's doing a building down there, that have expanded the harbor walk and allow the opportunity for protection on sea level rise and on the waterfront. We have philanthropists like the Bar Foundation making major investments in the city with parks and open space. This is going to be a uniform conversation between all of us that we need to continue to move forward. We don't have a timeline to say when this will be completed by, but we have a plan now, and we're going to take our plan now and start to implement the plan by making that $232 million investment that I've already talked about and really starting to plan out different areas. So, for example, in the North End, we have a plan already for some park space in the North End. We don't have a plan per se for Moakley Park. We have an idea, and we're in the beginning of a planning process. We've set aside money in the budget to plan that out. So as we think about planning, redesigning Moakley Park, a component of that now, a major component, will be resiliency. And people might not even understand what we're doing there, but we're creating creating an opportunity as the tide comes in through Carson Beach. Moakley Park will be there to protect the community from that rising tide.
What about cost estimate for the total part of this project? If we're talking about city money, we're talking about private money. I'm assuming state money.
Yeah.
What's total?
I don't have a cost because it's going to change. I mean, you're talking about if we could do the plan all in the next 5 years, the cost will be significantly different than it will be if it's over a 20-year period. And it's one of those things that I'm not ready yet to say what the cost will be, because a lot of places we don't have the plan for the specifics of what's needed in certain areas. We applied for a FEMA grant of $10 million. That money would help us design a four-point channel. And once that designation is done, we have two options there. One is to do a short-term fix, which would cost anywhere from $20 to $50 million, and a long-term fix would probably be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So, again, it's going to change as we think about what areas and what entry points of the city that we're looking at.
So what do you expect will be most challenging?
I'm not sure at this point. I think that today was an important step in having a conversation with the business community. I think the speech was well received by folks. I think people understand the urgency of taking action now for future generations of Bostonians, I think, and for the future of our city. And I think that, as we think about, I've already had some folks come up to me and saying, we're all in. We want to be part of this. We had the philanthropic community there. Amos Hostetler was there and his wife Barbara, and they were pleased, I think, with the conversation that we had today, as far as coming up with a plan. I think the first step in any type of movement is having an understanding of what's needed and the urgency of that and the plan, and we have that now. And now the next step is implementation of this plan.
So you're saying the city's applying for that $10 million. Will that sort of kickstart all of this?
No, we already have we've already invested $232 million in preparedness in our capital budget over the last couple of years. So we've been doing this for a long time. This is much more of a long-term complete vision of the Inner Harbor. And there's so much more that reducing carbon emissions and looking at all the other pieces that we can do here in the city. And then working with our neighbors in the north and the south about coming up with resilient plans all along the seacoast, not just here in Boston, but up and down the seacoast here in Massachusetts.
The timeline for all elements of this plan is what, the next 50 years?
I think it would have to be much earlier than 50 years. The UN report was talking about concerns of 2040. The flood maps and the flood conversations are 2070. So I think that we'd have to have it done much earlier than that.
Okay. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We want to turn now to WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, who was at the Chamber of Commerce event today. Bruce, how do you think people reacted to the mayor's speech? He said it went well.
Well, he did. He's right. I was there. There were about 700 people attending the breakfast. This was Walsh's fifth time talking to the group. And after this speech, I was surprised. People got up and gave him a standing ovation. There was also a woman I spoke to afterwards. Her name was Kathy Abbott. She's president and CEO of a group called Boston Harbor Now. So they have a direct link and interest in this. They work with public agencies and communities and companies to, quote, make Boston a world-class coastal city.
I could not have imagined a better speech, and I've never heard the mayor give a better speech than this one. He's really fired up on this. He sees the threat and the opportunity, which is incredibly exciting, but also very daunting.
Yeah, definitely daunting. I mean, this is tremendous ambitions. I'm not sure if you heard it in your conversation with the mayor now. I think he may be tired because he's been talking about this for a lot.
One part of the mayor's resilience strategy that was missing was an idea that has been floated to build this sort of movable harbor wall. What happened to that?
Well, the mayor put the kibosh on that. Yesterday, he told me that it was science fiction. He based his decision on the results of a study, actually, Deb, funded by the Boston Green Ribbon Committee. By chance, just met John Cleveland after the breakfast. He's head of the CEO network that's involved in the city's climate strategy.
The harbor barrier just doesn't pan out from a cost-benefit point of view. It doesn't solve the problem of chronic flooding from incremental sea level rise. It's a storm surge solution. But as the waters just go higher because the tides go higher, it doesn't solve that problem. And to solve that problem, you'd have to close the whole harbor off, and that just, like, really doesn't work.
So no harbor barrier, that's out. But what about other concerns? Were there concerns from the folks there?
A lot, yeah. As the mayor explained, this is a really ambitious project. It's a far-reaching strategy, right? So there's lots of moving pieces. This pulls them those pieces all together. And as he said, Boston is an island. There are cities and communities up and down the coast that need to get involved. And that raises some very, very basic questions. I talked to Eve Torre. She's the director of sustainability programs at Better City. It's a membership organization of, I think, something like 130 large Boston businesses. And they came together over the big dig.
Things that I'm most interested in seeing next steps on is who's going to govern it. We're part of a region. We're part of the state. So who's the governance of that? What does that governance look like? That's what I'm waiting to hear.
And what about the money? There's no clear price tag on this, as the mayor just told us, Bruce. And, he is going to look to the business community for some money here. Do you think people are on board with the way that this would be financed?
Well, there are a lot of pieces, as you say, and it's over a long period of time. And it's going to, there's inflation to account for and the cost of money to account for. So he's probably right not to put a price tag on it because there's so many moving pieces. So it's incremental. He is going to dedicate, as he said, the capital fund of 10% a year. It's about $15 to $20 million a year. He's got the 232 in the bank already. People are going to have to kick in. There's going to be philanthropies going to have to kick in, private companies, nonprofits going to have to kick in. It's going to take, and then the state and the feds. And the feds are going to be very reluctant. But as the mayor said, you pay me now or you pay me later. It's the cost of doing nothing against climate change. That's unacceptable. How much is it going to cost to bail out and to drain the big dig and the tunnels if they flood?
So what happens next here, Bruce?
Well, the mayor's in sales mode. He's got to sell his vision. He's generated buzz definitely today. As I said, I think his speech was very well received. But he's got to figure out how to sustain the momentum.
All right, WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, ahead of Boston's Asian American Film Festival, we talk about the evolution of Asian American films with a star from the movie The Joy Luck Club. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Boston Asian American Film Festival marks its 10th anniversary this year, a milestone during what some say is a new era for Asian American stories on the screen. The festival kicks off tomorrow with the screening of the now 25-year-old film, The Joy Luck Club. Organizer Susan Chinson says this movie helped pave the way for the current wave of popular Asian American films.
We are not where we are now because of just what we've done in the past few years, but rather this is part of a legacy of creatives that have had an impact that we are now feeling.
Rosalind Chow, one of the stars of the Joy Luck Club, is in town for the festival, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So the Joy Luck Club was a major film. Let's remind folks on this 25th anniversary. It was a major film about the relationships between four young Chinese-American women who grew up here and their mothers who were first-generation immigrants. And we have a bit of a clip from a scene that I'm going to play here where one of the young women is talking about the mothers who bonded over regular games of regular games. Let's listen.
My mother started the Joy Luck Club having met all these women in church. Auntie Ame, Auntie Lindo, Auntie Ying Ying. For 30 years, these women feasted, forgot past wrongs, laughed and played, lost and won, and told the best stories. Each week, they hoped to be lucky. And that hope was their only joy. Their connection with each other had more to do with hope than joy or luck.
Rosalind Chow, remind us of of what that film meant and how big a hit it was 25 years ago.
It was huge because it was the first time that Asian Americans saw themselves on screen in a major motion picture. So I can remember a friend of mine seeing it, and he said tears were rolling down his cheeks the second Joy Luck Club came on and he heard the music. It was very meaningful at the time.
So for you, in your professional world, what kind of roles were you playing until then? Remind us of what it was like for someone trying to get into Hollywood then.
Well, just prior to that, I had done a film called Thousand Pieces of Gold, where I played the first Chinese-American pioneer woman. And she did not speak English, and this was a welcome change. I think that's where Wayne first saw me, was in that film. So here we got to be ourselves, essentially. Yeah. Although I'm not like Rose exactly, I'm a much bossier wife. But we did get to reflect the Asian-American experience, which we never had seen on screen.
Now, so many folks said, oh, the Joy Luck Club shows a movement's coming, and this is a whole new time for Asian American actors and films. Was it?
It didn't turn out to be. We were very hopeful. But I do think social media has changed that. And I also think that the Asian American community has learned how to get behind our projects and to be supportive of each other. And I really think John Chu helped to lead that charge. It's been huge.
Yeah, but why didn't it work, do you think? Why didn't it work for the Joy Luck Club?
I do believe that it was one of the first films. Mm. So we really didn't, Asian Americans didn't know how to get behind our own works. And we were more concerned with what we didn't see in Joy Luck Club than what was there. And
such
so,
as?
I think everybody had a different opinion about what they had hoped to see in the film. Mm-hmm. And expectations were very high. Although, you know, overall, we were supported. There just wasn't enough of a push. We weren't, you know, the publicity wasn't huge. The marketing, it all just didn't come together the way it has with Crazy Rich Asians and this perfect storm.
Well, let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians. One of the scenes, we also have a clip from one of the scenes of that movie, and that's where the character Nick Young asks his girlfriend, the character Rachel Chu, to come to Singapore and meet his family. Let's listen.
Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family, my Ama. I meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Take Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
So that's a scene from the movie Crazy Rich Asians. And I'm wondering, is this the turning point for Asian American actors in films?
I'm very optimistic because we have a lot more, I'm seeing a lot more interesting Asian American filmmakers out there. We have, there's interest. It's very exciting.
But, you know, it seems like it's almost similar here with Crazy Rich Asians. Very high expectations and some criticism there about Singapore and the portrayal of Asian Americans in Singapore. I mean, it seems like maybe Asian American films are still trying to find their footing here when it comes to Hollywood.
Right. But as long as we're making headway, I'm optimistic. And I really do think this time it's a big change. I mean, Awkwafina being on Saturday Night Live. We're doing the new live action Mulan. There's going to be a lot of Asian representation coming up. Mm-hmm. And Asian males, the Asian male representation for Crazy Rich Asians has been a real turning point. We're no longer invisible in that, you know, we were only thought of in sort of a fetishy sense before. And now I think we're thought of as more of the fabric of America, which is really wonderful.
Do you think of a particular story or anecdote when we're at a moment like this and you say, I remember when I had to
X to X, or maybe have a non-speaking role in a film. But, you know, is there something that you can say, I know we've come a long way and made a lot of progress because I remember this?
Well, the one thing that yellow-facing is something that I thought we were beyond. And it has just recently started happening
again. Tell us what yellow-facing is.
Yellow-facing is similar to blackface, where a white person, portrays a person of Asian American descent. And in a perfect world where everybody can play everything and all things are equal, it would be fine. But because there isn't enough representation of Asian Americans, it would be nice if Asian Americans could represent Asian Americans. Mm. So that has just recently come to the forefront. And the reaction to that has told me that things are changing. We're a lot more vocal as a community. And, you know, white people, black people, everyone's been speaking out against yellowface, which has been, we've had support from people of every color.
Mm-hmm. And better marketing this time around, right? And social
definitely,
media.
Definitely.
So you mentioned Mulan.
Yes.
You just finished filming for that. What can you tell us about that?
I'm not allowed to tell very much, but the only thing I will tell you that it's going to be spectacular. It's being directed by Nikki Caro, who's well known for Whale Rider, among many other films. And it's starring an actress who's the Julia Roberts of China. Her name is Yifei. And there, Gong Li is in it, and a host of very hunky young men. I just left New Zealand being surrounded by them. And it's an all-Asian American cast, all-Asian cast. So it's very exciting. It's going to be a dramatic version of it's not a musical and nothing like the animated.
Huh. Okay. Well, you told us a good amount. Thank you. So why do you think a film festival like the Boston Asian American Film Festival dedicated to Asian Americans is important?
Well, I think it's wonderful for us to have the opportunity to get our work out there in a place where, you know, certain projects might not normally be seen, low-budget films, and this is a way for us to nurture our Asian American filmmakers and Asian American artists. And any opportunity to do that, I think, is wonderful.
If you had attended something like this when you were young, starting out, do you think it would have made a difference?
I don't know. I really believe everything happens when it's meant to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a real turning point. And the fact that some of the films being shown at this festival, I'd heard buzz about. So it's wonderful that they are really doing the work to get the word out there instead of just having it, you know, be amongst the Asian American community.
Mm-hmm. Is there something you're most looking forward to?
I think the last film for Izzy, I'm looking forward to. It's starring an Asian American actress who was a friend of mine who just recently passed away and is a wonderful actress. So I am looking forward to seeing how that is. I heard it's great.
All right. Well, great. Well, Rosalind Chow is in town for the Boston Asian American Film Festival, which runs from October 18th to the 28th. You can go to baaff.org to find a schedule, locations, and special guests. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we talk with Massachusetts Democratic 3rd Congressional District candidate Lori Trahan. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We're now less than 3 weeks away from the midterm elections, and voters in Massachusetts' 3rd District will choose a new member of Congress. It's a sprawling district represented by retiring Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas for more than a decade. Earlier this week, we heard from Rick Green, the Republican, seeking the seat. Today, we turn to the Democratic nominee, Lori Trahan. Trahan faced a tough primary fight, coming out ahead of 9 other candidates and
and after a recount, it was determined that she won by less than 150 votes. Trahan is a small business owner and former chief of staff to former Congressman Marty Meehan. Lori, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So let's start with your experience. As we said, you served as a chief of staff and aide to Marty Meehan when he was in Congress. What did you learn from that job that made you want to run for office and not run away?
Well, I think what gives me confidence that I can be a good representative for this district is my experience working in that office, because I got to know the district really well. I mean, I grew up in Lowell, and I've lived in the district my whole life, but you get a view of all the issues affecting the district, and they're diverse, right? I mean, there's towns like Concord where passing legislation to protect the Sudbury, Concord, and Assabet Rivers is very important to them. And then you could be working on an economic development project in Lowell or Lawrence, something that can really transform the trajectory of a community. So, you know, I really got rooted in the district and the issues that were important to those communities. Mm. You know, I also had a fair amount of experience down in Washington. Eventually became the congressman's chief of staff, worked on campaign finance reform, and learned how to work in a bipartisan way. You know, that was a heavily negotiated bill. And so I think
campaign
those,
finance reform.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. It took a long time to pass. And, you know, it was an experience in how you can find common ground with Republicans to pass landmark legislation.
But now, yikes, right? I mean, all we hear about is how divisive, you know, Congress is and what's going on now. And I mean, you'd have to say, right, it's gotten worse since the days when you were working with Marty Meehan. So
yes.
I wonder, what, if you're elected, would you do to try to help improve that situation?
Yeah,
I think that's the million-dollar question, right?
It
Everyone
sure
wants
is.
To figure that out.
It sure is. You know, I'm a proud lifelong Democrat, but running for office was never part of the plan. It wasn't. After my time with the congressional office, I actually shifted and went to the private sector. But I did feel like the 2016 election changed everything. And I think it is my experience working across industries with business executives, with entrepreneurs, that reminded me when disruption happens, change follows. Now, we've never seen a more disruptive force in Washington than this president and this administration. But I think what gives me a lot of optimism is that these midterms are the change that follow. And I do think that there's an opportunity to break the gridlock, to change business as usual. I mean, when you have this many people across the country who have never run before, never thought of running before, frankly,
right,
all going to Washington at the same time, I think that that new breed of leader, the freshness, will help, you know, stir things up and maybe change that partisan politics that we're seeing right now.
Yeah. You know, you've I believe been described though for sure as a pragmatic progressive. What does that mean to you?
I really want to be effective. I really want to get things done. I have, you know, I embrace a bold vision of where our country needs to go. But I also, I think that there's an opportunity after these midterms to really hear the country and the plight of working class families and roll up our sleeves and get things done. So, you know, I was just yesterday in Lawrence with Leader Pelosi and Congresswoman Clark and Congresswoman Tsongas, and we're talking about the importance of protecting people who have pre-existing conditions and their security and having insurance coverage. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's under attack. And the pragmatic side of me is, you know, we have to have a bold vision for transforming our healthcare system. But in the meantime, I mean, we have to really safeguard those principles and the dignity that the ACA gave so many people, people like my dad who has multiple sclerosis and really did live in fear that his insurance would be taken away. And we have to build on that and we have to improve it. I mean, the reality is premiums are too high. Prescription drug costs are too high.
But then what do you tell the people in your district who blame the ACA for that?
Well, you know, I don't think that the the high cost of prescription drugs. It was something that I think the ACA was going to come back and address. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, right? Because right after its passage, we were, you know, defending and protecting it, and it was slowly getting dismantled by the Republicans in this Congress. And so the opportunity to get back to the table and figure out how we add transparency to prescription drug pricing, how we enforce price gouging, how we make it more affordable for those, you know, medicines that people need is an important next step.
You know, you mentioned Nancy Pelosi, who was here earlier this week. You hosted a fundraiser with Nancy Pelosi. I wonder if you were elected, would you support her as leader in the House?
You know, I do get this question quite a bit. Yeah. And so I first have to say, because I've admired her career, the first woman Speaker of the House. What she's done for women and for working class families is really a model. I think a lot of us could emulate. But right now, I am 100% focused on getting elected. You know, someone reminded me the other day that, you know, the primary was long and hard fought. You know, I was the last named Democratic nominee in the country. So, you know, these weeks have been really spent getting ready for the November 6th election. But I look forward to making a decision and having those conversations about the leadership of the party after I get elected.
Just haven't made that decision quite yet. Okay, well, let's talk about policy a little bit. We spoke with your Republican challenger, Rick Green, on the show earlier this week, and we asked him to outline his views on some issues. He told us he is opposed to sanctuary cities and he supports greater border security. And he said this about background checks and gun legislation. Let's listen.
I'm a supporter of the Bill of Rights, which includes the 10th Amendment, which is, you know, states' rights. One size fits all coming out of D.C. to me is usually the wrong answer. Massachusetts has our laws and the people of Massachusetts are very happy with them. At the same time, we wouldn't want to live under the laws of, say, Wyoming or Texas, but also understand that the people of Wyoming and Texas may not want to live under our laws.
Okay, so I wonder, Lori Trahan, what about you on background checks and gun legislation?
Yep, this is a point that we just disagree on. I do believe in universal background checks. I mean, I think that's a place where we could actually come together as a country, Republicans and Democrats, to solve a problem that is, you know, facing our country, facing our kids. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing the due diligence to make sure we're not selling a gun to somebody who could hurt themselves or hurt someone else. And frankly, you know, there's people who aren't cleared to fly our planes should not be able to own a gun. You know, I think I don't think that this is a state issue. I think this is something that we have to take up on the federal level, and I think it's important.
Another issue in the district, sanctuary cities. Where do you stand on those? Mr. Green's opposed to sanctuary cities.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a decision for communities, for individual communities. I've known Mayor Dan Rivera for a long time.
Lawrence Mayor.
Who I used to work with. And, you know, the other night we had a debate and my opponent came down really hard on the city of Lawrence and referenced a fentanyl bust that happened in the city. This notion that Mayor Rivera is not cooperating when those busts happen is just, it's wrong. I mean, he's as invested in bringing, you know, violent criminals to justice as anyone. And so I think that, you know, this fear-mongering around, you know, fentanyl trafficking, targeting communities of color, this is where him and I don't see eye to eye. The role of Congress is to pass comprehensive immigration reform. That is our job. It's our laws are outdated. This is an area where Senators Kennedy and Senator McCain actually found a way to work together and pass a bill that not only strengthened our borders, but also, you know, addressed some of the problems with our immigration system, our acceptance criteria, evaluating, you know, how we seek how we evaluate asylum seekers, updating our visa program so it takes into account our skills gap and our American workers. That is the role of Congress, and that's the kind of productive conversation we should be having.
So you would support a city that would be a sanctuary city. Would you say that you would support a city's ability to declare itself a sanctuary city?
I believe right now that what Lawrence Mayor Rivera is doing is protecting nonviolent, undocumented immigrants who are going to the RMV and without notice getting picked up and separated from their family for really, you know, no reason. Mm-hmm. What he's not doing is you know, allowing violent criminals to live in his city. So, you know, what's right for Lawrence might not be right for Lowell, and I respect that that decision should be kept with local law enforcement and local officials.
The opioid epidemic, which has been an issue everywhere. Now, there was a bill. Actually, there was bipartisan agreement in Congress on an opioid bill very recently. What other things do you think that federal lawmakers need to do to address the opioid epidemic, or what would you like to try to work on regarding that issue?
Yes.
Do you have a specific plan at this point or not yet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't travel far in this district and not be confronted with a heartbreaking story. And the reality is cities like Lowell, Lawrence, and Haverhill are disproportionately impacted by this epidemic. And, you know, certainly I think we need more funding. We need more federal resources. I mean, the bill that was passed that, you know, funded more medically assisted treatment and more comprehensive centers, I mean, it's a start. But we have to make Narcan more available. I mean, we have to keep people alive. We do have to put more funding behind medically assisted treatment. If there's anything I've learned, this is not something you beat with willpower alone. The recovery is long. So not only do we have to have a long-term approach, but we have to give people the skills that they need to get back on their feet, reunited with their families, into a good-paying job so that we decrease that relapse rate. Hmm.
The third district includes some of the communities affected by the Columbia gas explosion and that over-pressurization. If you were elected, what do you think Congress, what would you want Congress or try to get Congress to do for the affected communities there?
Yeah. So, you know, first and foremost, I think we have to see what this investigation surfaces. You know, there are too many questions right now around how this happened, how we maintain our pipelines, how we prevent this from ever happening again. You know, I'm mindful right now that what needs to be done is we have to accelerate this timeline for people to get their gas turned back on, because the reality is on Thursday night, I think I read the temperature is going to dip to 23 degrees. Mm-hmm. I mean, that means people need to be relocated very quickly into hotel rooms, into RVs. And I know that there's good planning in place right now, but we have to hold Columbia Gas accountable. We have to make sure that we have a plan in place to maintain our pipelines. And I think what another thing that it does is it shines a light on our urgency around transitioning to renewable energy.
Okay. Lori Trahan, Democratic candidate for Congress in the 3rd District, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we spoke with the Republican in the race, Rick Green. You can find that conversation on our website, radioboston.org. Next week, we'll be joined by independent candidate Mike Mullen. Well, it's time now for sports, and we begin with the game-defining moment in Houston last night. You can try.
Swing and a high fly ball right field. Reddick back. Reddick at the track. Turning. Looking. Out of here. Jackie Bradley Jr.
That's the sound of center fielder Jackie Bradley Jr.'s grand slam that took the Red Sox to victory over the Astros. And Boston Globe sports media columnist Chad Finn was at the game. He joins us from Houston. Chad, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
So we heard that sound at the top of the grand slam by Jackie Bradley Jr. Was anyone expecting that from him when he stepped up to the plate?
Maybe Jackie himself, but not too many others. He's not the best hitter in the Red Sox lineup. He's probably the streakiest. He'll have great weeks and a couple of poor weeks, and never really any middle ground with him. But he's been very good in the playoffs, and he was especially good last night.
So what's the energy like in Houston?
You know, the energy is really good here. It's Fenway has been funny during this series because you can hear a pocket of Astros fans all the time, no matter what. And I've had people ask me if it's apathy because Boston sports teams have done so well that you kind of expect it. Maybe you don't root as hard as you normally would. But here, it's a little bit different. The Astros crowd is really lively and animated. And when Bradley hit that home run last night, it got really, really quiet very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's a good place to watch a ball game out here, but maybe not for the home crowd last night.
Now, there's a story floating around about sign stealing when an opposing team tries to decode the hand signals that the players and coaches are communicating with each other. The Globe is reporting that the league's investigating someone connected to the Astros. How serious are these allegations?
Well, Major League Baseball just sent out a press release maybe about 5 minutes ago, it was really recent, saying that they've concluded their investigation and basically there's nothing to see here. So it's either that there really is nothing there and that it was just a little bit of, at worst, gamesmanship that maybe got nipped in the bud, or it's Major League Baseball looking at this and saying, if we make a big deal out of this, we may be opening up a huge can of worms around Major League Baseball, because this kind of is the sort of thing that technology has brought upon the game, where a lot of different ways to try and gauge what the other team is doing and intercept signals and try to get a read on their signs. And Houston Astros are a very advanced organization, but they're not the only ones doing this. And I think Major League Baseball probably wanted to push this aside as quickly as possible for fear that a lot more stuff would come out. What they really need is to implement some rules and to make sure those rules about technology are followed.
Two teams play again tonight. What are the main things you're looking for in tonight's game?
Well, Rick Porcello is a starting pitcher for the Red Sox, and he's an interesting guy because he won the Cy Young Award in 2016 as the best pitcher in the American League. He won 22 games and lost only four, but he's been about average over the course of his career. He's very durable, and he always makes a start, and he's good more often than not, but he's not somebody who you look at and say, this is our ace, this is the guy who's going to go out and win the big game that we need. And yet, this postseason, he's been absolutely terrific, whether it's starting a game or coming in relief as he did in the Yankees series and again earlier in this series and shutting down the opposition when the moment really calls for it. So he's building a reputation and a resume as a big-game pitcher this postseason. And tonight, with the Red Sox up 2-1 in the series and him going to the mound as a starter, has a chance to enhance that even more. I think Red Sox fans probably looked at Rick Porcello for much of the season and much of his time here and said, yeah, he's pretty good. Now they're looking at him as someone who can go out and win a game that means a whole heck of a lot. And that's a great reputation for a pitcher to have.
You know, it was an exciting night for the Celtics, too. I guess I heard that you watched the second half of their season opener after the Red Sox. Oh, the troubles we have, Boston sports fans. But what did you think of last night's Celtics game?
It was exactly, I think, everything Celtics fans wanted to see. I mean, the anticipation for the season basically began 5 minutes after last season ended with a Game 7 loss to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals. The Celtics got that far last year without their two best and two highest, might be their two highest paid players, two of their top three anyway, and Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward, who was, of course, injured in the first 6 minutes of the first game of the season. So get to see the whole gang together again, and they went out and played like they've been together for 5-10 years. The connection was perfect. And you look at the statistics on this game, and Kyrie Irving didn't hit a basket in the first half. He's their best player, and yet they still won by 20 points over a very good team. I think it was a very good hint as to what's to come with this team. And expectations are high, and they really should be.
So let's move on to the Patriots. And before we get to sort of the team this year, let's talk about the Boston Globe's, just briefly, the new Spotlight series and podcast looking at the life of Aaron Hernandez. He, of course, is the former Patriots player who committed suicide while serving a prison sentence for murder. I mean, what do you think that readers are learning from this? What do you take from this long look at Aaron Hernandez's life and what happened here?
Well, this was a massive story, obviously, when it broke, and then the trial, and then his suicide in jail. Something that has been covered intensely by a lot of different markets, a lot of different outlets, locally and nationally. It felt like that there might not be anything more to unearth with this, and yet our Spotlight series has found detail after detail that was previously unreported or might have been reported offhandedly or not thoroughly, and they dug deeper into it. It's not just the jailhouse calls that, our reporters have from Hernandez to, various people, but talk to Patriots players who, you know, they've shut down pretty much everybody who's tried to talk to them over these last couple of years. And then we've gotten real detail about how he was perceived in the locker room and how he behaved. DJ Hernandez, his brother, now he's, Jonathan, I believe he goes by now, has been very candid. And I think the podcast version of this really enhances all of it because you get to hear the people's voices and hear the emotion in their voice and how they speak about this stuff when they're talking about such a controversial and tragic and dramatic story.
Right. Well, you don't have to sell a radio person on that. So just give us very briefly, just a couple of seconds, upcoming game against the Bears.
I think the Patriots are really trending the right way here. The Kansas City win was a thriller and a hard-fought game. The Bears have had their ups and downs, but you get the sense they're not quite ready for what the Patriots are bringing right now. I think New England wins again and probably pretty easily.
All right. Chad Finn, sports columnist at the Boston Globe. Links to the Spotlight series and podcast, as well as Chad's latest commentary, are at our website, radioboston.org. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston.